Okay, welcome everyone to the 2016 Folklife Festival. Welcome to the On the Move tent, where we have sessions every hour on the hour. And it's our privilege today to welcome Debbie Wong and Great Leap.
Good morning, everyone. Now it is. Great to see all of you. You are the hardcore. You know, it's a gray day, right? It's a gray day. It's still fairly early. Really glad you're here. I've been at the festival for a few days now, and I can say that this space, this tent, as it were, there have been some amazing conversations going on in here. And this is the On the Move space where migration and movement is being discussed. And in a way, this tent is the connector between the two big themes of the festival, right? The Sounds of California and Basque identity. So we're going to be talking today about Japanese American identity, which is not the same thing as Japanese identity. It has to do with immigration and with some, you know, spectacularly violent moments in American history as well. But we'll come to that down the line in just a bit. Now, listen, I think it's very important in this space in particular for us to talk with you as well. So if you have questions or responses as we go along, I say raise your hand and speak up. I think that would be great, okay? The last few days of spending time with my friends and my colleagues and my peers here has been one of my great life experiences. Let me very, very quickly introduce you to the panelists. Elaine Fukumoto on the end, who is a taiko player and a dance teacher. And please come at either 1:15 or 4:15 to hear us do our thing, which is a project called Fandang Obon, and we'll be doing it in the Sounds of California tent twice today. And Elaine is leading the dance in that. Next to her is Nobuko Miyamoto, a legendary singer from the Asian American movement years of the 70s especially, but she didn't stop after the 1970s. And she is the heart and soul of our project, the creator of the Fandang Obon project. Next to her, George Abe, an extraordinary musician, well known in the Japanese community of Southern California and frankly far beyond, for his work as a musician in the original, one of the originating taiko ensembles in the United States, Kinara Taiko, out of Senshin Buddhist Temple. He's also known for his drumming in obon ceremonies or festivals in the summertime. He's a bondaiko player, in short. Next to him is Nancy Sakizawa, Atomic Nancy. If you're looking at the Smithsonian blog for the festival, which I hope you are because it's pretty fantastic, there's a great profile of Nancy there just posted this morning. So it's right at the top of the blog right now. If you really want to know what's going on with this woman, read that profile. It's going to blow your mind. It's like super interesting. Her history is so interesting. I expect some of that will come out as we proceed. Next to me is Sean Miura, who is very much a community activist, I would even say community agitator in a really great way, in a productive way in terms of the art, and that too will come out as we proceed. He's a shamisen player. He is, I don't even know how to describe you because you do so many things and it all connects in a way that I want to come forward as we talk today. Let's start with some, you know, sort of straightforward matters. What generation are each of you? Surely you know that in a context of immigration and migration, what generation you are matters very, very much indeed. In ethnic studies, we say that the first generation are the folks who emigrated from someplace else to here, in this case, which would be the United States. Second generation are the children of those original migrants, right? Now, third generation and so on. I think we also know that often generation is way more complicated than that. What happens when people move back and forth? You know, these kinds of questions. So it's important to get that out here with the relative generations within the Japanese American experience. We're gonna have to hand this mic around. So oh good, there's two. What generation are each of you? And explain the Japanese terms for generation as we go along.
Okay, I am third generation. My grandparents came to from Hiroshima, Japan. My parents were special niseis. They were Kibei niseis. So they were born here, so they're citizens, but they went back to Japan to be educated. So my mom went back as an infant and came back to get married. My dad left at about 9 and came back at the age of 18. So that's what Kibei Nisei is, and I'm just a regular Sansei, third generation.
I'm a Sansei, third generation, sort of a mixed blood. My grandmother was a Mormon American, and my other grandmother was a picture bride. But I call myself a Japanese American, a Sansei. But you know what? Can I do something? I want everybody just in the house here just to say what generation they are, because I just like to know. Can we start with you? Well, you don't know, right? How many generations your people have been in this country? You don't know. 3, 5, 4, 3, 2, 4, 7. Okay, long time. 6. In the back row there? 5 or 6 next year? 1. Uh-huh. So, okay. That's
awesome. I'm Nisei and a half. Yeah, Elaine, my mother was Kibei, which means she was born in Orange, California, went back to Japan in about the fourth grade, came back to the United States when she was about 26. And so culturally, I'm 2 and a half. So I speak a little Japanese. She was a Japanese school teacher, and generationally, I like to say I'm 2 and a half, Nisei Han.
I'm third generation, parents born in, my father was born in Whitefish, Montana, and then my mother was born in Kemmer, Wyoming, but got their education in Japan and then came back.
I am 3 3/4 generation, but I say I'm a fourth generation, so Yonsei. And just to sort of provide a little bit of context as to why we're saying generations, because I think that's, in many other communities, that's not something that you talk about often. For people of color, like policy and history and waves of immigration really affect our generational cultures and the way that we're perceived and the way that we perceive the country and the world. So with that, each generation has come different challenges and different strengths and different victories. So it's as we talk more, you'll get a better sense of that, I think.
One of the things that Asian Americans have to deal with constantly is often based strictly on terms of what our faces look like, not being regarded as being fully American or, you know, of the U.S., right? What we often have to explain is what it means to be Japanese American or Chinese American, which is not the same as being Japanese, right? However, we carry traces of the home country in all kinds of ways through our family life. And very quickly, I wonder, do each of you have Japanese names? And I'm not going to say in addition to your American names, but rather, you know, what is the interaction between the two if you, in fact, have more than one name?
Since I'm holding the mic, my name is Tetsuo in Japanese. Kind of means, never mind.
What does it mean?
Well, long story short, it means like iron. The characters are like iron and having, you know, strength, those kind of things. Yeah.
most of my very young life, I was Joanne. I didn't even know that I had a Japanese name because I'm a post-war. Well, no, I'm a pre-war baby. I was born just before the beginning of the war. So we were busy trying to be American. So they gave me, Joanne was my name, and only after I was in the Asian American movement in the late 60s and early 70s did I reclaim my Japanese name, which is Nobuko, and that's all I use now.
Most of my Japanese American JA friends, their middle name is Japanese, but my father thought I was Japanese first, so my first name is Mariko, and my middle name is Elaine. And my father got my middle name off of a radio program.
Actually, that's true with me, too. My first name is Nobuko on my birth certificate, And my middle name was Joanne.
My first name is George, like George Washington. Everybody wanted their kids to be the president of the United States.
So my middle name is really interesting. It's most of the girls have a K-O, Cole, like Machiko, Michiko, Nobuko. So my father's first name, they took the first syllable of my father's name, which is Minoru, me. And the first syllable of my mother's name, her name is Ito. So Mi-I-Ko. So that's my name, Miko.
So my first name is Sean, and my middle name is Takeo, which comes from my grandfather. But just to give a little bit of, there is actually a story behind that, and for in the on the move tent, that's related to immigration. So my great great grandfather immigrated from Fukuoka to mine in Utah, and he immigrated without papers. So he came through Mexico, which was very common back then. And so in our family, there was like a single character that was passed down from generation to generation, from male to male, kind of like how you'll have like James, like the James Senior, James Junior, the third, the fourth, and so on. We would take like one character and then we pass that character down. So it was like Sakumon, Sakuichi, and Sakui. And then when we got to America, because my great-great-grandfather was so ashamed that he had come over without papers, he had his son, when he had his first child, my grandfather, he had him change the name completely and take that character out. And so that's how he became Takeo. And so my grandfather was actually born on the 4th of July. So his name was Gibbs, his birthday is tomorrow. Happy birthday to Sean's grandfather. And so he was born on the 4th of July, and his father gave him a Japanese name, and the doctor said, well, no one's going to be able to say that. So let's name him Paul after Paul Revere. So his name is Paul Takeo Bannai, which is, and so Takeo means warrior, like warrior dude, kind of warrior man. And so it's funny because my grandfather not only became a soldier because of warrior Takeo, but he also became a very Republican politician in California. So the first Japanese American assemblyman. So it's the names kind of have power. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. I did not know that, and that's like, that is fantastic. Wow. I should say that I'm actually Chinese American. I'm actually also multi-ethnic. Hey, did you know that it's possible to have more than one self-identity? Have you gone down that path yet? Yeah, right? Got any pure people out there? All right. Yeah, right, exactly. I'm half white American, which in my case is a mixture of Scottish and German. The other half of me is Chinese, specifically from the Guangdong or the Toishan area of southern China. And I do have a Chinese name. My grandmother was very careful to make that happen. All of the cousins have Chinese names. I'm really distracted by that in a great way. Next question for my friends here. When do you feel most Japanese American? And I mean Japanese American, not Japanese, because none of you are, in fact, Japanese. And I'm asking this because, in my opinion, feeling and emotions are not like something that are always simply personal and private and unique to oneself. But I would argue that feelings and emotions are actually very much related to the big world of power and politics and outside forces that shape who we are and what we're able to feel. So here's my question to you. When do you feel most Japanese American? And I can say that as, you know, I feel most Chinese American in at least two different contexts. One, when my father, who died 16 years ago, would make a juk the day after Thanksgiving every year, when he would, this is the part he liked best about Thanksgiving, he would take the carcass from the turkey and he would boil it for like a day and the house would smell amazing, right? I would feel particularly Chinese American the day after Thanksgiving. I feel most Asian American when I'm with other Asian American friends, right? So that's my example. When do you feel most Japanese American, whatever that may mean to you?
Okay. I think the festivals, the Japanese festivals, like we celebrate Obon. Obon is a kind of a festival like the Day of the Dead, you know, celebrating our ancestors, looking back and saying, we're going to dance in joy because we're here because of our ancestors, you know, so celebrating that kind of thing. The many different forms that it takes. And really, you know, this Obon festival that we do is a very Japanese-American thing. It's not, they don't do it the same way in Japan. They don't do it the same way. It, for us, in a way, it's a way to celebrate our culture and better feel better about ourselves. You know, we're here in America, and we experience racism and those kinds of things. But as a community, when it comes together and you dance together in circles and stuff like that, it's great. Yeah.
I'm a little confused. How do I feel as a Japanese American, or when? Japanese or Japanese
where?
American?
Japanese American.
No, what's the difference there?
Whoa. Ah. Okay.
What's
yeah.
The difference?
Give it right back to me there. Yeah. Yeah. I'll let you pursue that as you like, because I have no skin in the game of trying to, like, you know, put people in the categories. That's not my intent.
I think being in, why we're here, performing and sharing the culture is, that's when I feel Japanese or Japanese American. So I'm taking this part of me, my Japanese American, Japanese part of me, and sharing it with the public. And I think in any playing taiko, sharing that Japanese part of me with the general public.
I was born, you know, in West Los Angeles in a very small Japanese community called Sawtelle in West LA. So feeling the separation of being American or Japanese when I speak English, and then that's when I feel like I'm Japanese, but then identifying myself as Japanese is when I really go down to Little Tokyo and being around my people. So I grew up probably just feeling, every day I feel Japanese American. I mean, like today, I feel Japanese American, exposing some of our culture, sharing some of our culture and our ideas, but speaking English to able to communicate how we feel, it's very different. It's very different, and I feel quite confident as an Asian woman. You know, I think it's more of an Asian woman, but I know my culture is Japanese. So when I go to Little Tokyo, I sit down in a restaurant, I walk around there, that's my playground.
I think that was interesting, though. What's the difference? Because that actually, that does get me going, because I do think, like, well, to me, they're very distinct. So I think where I feel, so, I mean, first off, the answer is that I always feel very Japanese American. So, all like, right. I think, like, it's, I was very lucky to be raised in a generation where difference has been celebrated to an extent. Obviously, we're still facing a lot of, without swearing, messed up things in the world. And obviously, we're sort of in this continuous fight for equality and just respect on, like, a systemic and social level. But I think, like, I was generally raised within a sense that, yeah, if you're different and you come from a culture that is other, quote unquote, other, meaning non-mainstream white generally, that comes with a lot of sort of specialness, and, like, you're able to come to show and tell with whatever you picked off your kitchen table. You know, it's like it's cool. But where I think then I feel the most Japanese American, like, where I'm like, oh, this is very Japanese American of me, is when I'm in a moment where I'm speaking with somebody and speaking about something with words that could not be understood contextually by somebody from who is who is American, like mainstream white American, or non-Japanese American, but could also not be understood by someone from Japan. So, like, if I start talking to somebody about Obon and I just, like, go up to you and I'm like, hey, you want to go down to J-Town? Obon's happening that night. And I figure we could stop by Sue's and grab teriyaki chicken. that may sound to you very, very Japanese, but in truth, if you said that to a native Japanese person, they'd be like, I don't know what the hell you're saying right now. Like, what are these words? Like, why are you butchering our language? So it's there is this, like, space that we exist in that's different. And I think that's kind of where I feel the most. I'm able to be like, oh, that's kind of cool that I can just say that. And no one could go, got it, I'll be right there, you know? I also feel the most Japanese-American when I'm getting compliments. Because it's like, I think that's one thing that's gotten passed down generation to generation is like the inability to take compliments. It's like, I feel very uncomfortable when people start calling me and I start going like, oh, okay, you know. Like, no one ever told me to do that. It's just something that I got, I think so.
Sean is really good. He like breaks it down, you know. Anyway, I'm going to break it down in three levels. First, I don't dress like this every day. Probably, you know, maybe a couple of three times a year. So it's people are looking at me in this festival like this is my normal way. I don't wear shoes like this. This is not normal for me. So I feel, when I dress like this, I feel very Japanese American. That's one thing. The other thing is, I live in a household. My child is African American and Japanese, so I'm always feeling Japanese American. My husband now is African American. I live surrounded mostly in an African American household. Because my mother-in-law stays there 6 months out of the year. She's 107 years old, born in Ellisville, Mississippi, is living in. So I find that there's a big problem that I have in communication between that comes out because I'm a very high context person. I don't answer questions directly. What do you want to do? Oh, what do you want to do? So I defer a lot to people around me. Like this. Yeah, no. So my husband can't stand it. Just say what you want. Say what you want to do. And I find myself unable to do that. And I'm trying to explain to him, this is part of my culture. And he doesn't really understand that. So that's when I feel very Japanese and Japanese American.
I want to make a point that I think most of us here are more Japanese than the people in Japan. The kids in Japan, they're learning to play piano and the violin and ballet. And here we have young people here learning to play the shamisen and other Japanese instruments. People in Japan, they don't know how to dress themselves like this. You know, so they're in awe that we're more Japanese than they are in Japan. They're becoming so westernized, and here we are trying to maintain the culture. And yes, it's a sad thing. So someone's got to keep it up.
Yeah. Wow. I'm loving this conversation, and I love the ways in which, you know, the things that each of you raised, you know, goes right to the heart of one of the big questions for this. This part of the festival, what is home? It's on the back board there, and that's what I'm pointing at. And what it comes down to is that, you know, when and where you feel at home, when and where you are able to feel safe and most fully yourself, most comprehensively yourself, you know, changes from moment to moment and place to place, in fact. And I think it's important to acknowledge that we are not able, especially folks of color in the United States, are not able, are not permitted, are not allowed to feel safe and most fully themselves in all spaces, right? You know, I mean, surely this is self-evident at this point. I need to turn the conversation to the Japanese-American internment, to EO 9066, passed in the early months of 1942. I expect, but I can't be sure, that all of you know that from 1942 to 1945, all Japanese Americans and Japanese within a certain zone of the West Coast had their civil liberties violated. And between 110 and 125,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans were put in concentration camps. I'd like to give you have a sense. I know, this is like frankly, I love the fact that the soundscape of the festival is as thick and dense and often competing as it is. But bear with me on this. Listen to both me and them. I think it's absolutely possible to listen to more than one thing at a time. And I think that as people, as we all are at this festival, committed to living through difference and recognizing difference and being with people who are different from ourselves, that means being able to listen to more than one thing at a time, right? So you all just did great. I want to talk about internment. I want to ask each of our panelists here, if you don't mind, you know, no pressure if you don't want to talk about this, of course, because these are painful histories, painful memories within the JA community. What is your family history with the internment, and in what ways do you feel this continues to be part of your family history?
I was 2 years old when I went to Santa Anita Racetrack. We were in there with 10,000 other people. I don't really remember that much. I have one image of riding on my uncle's shoulders to mess hall. You know, we had to eat food that was very unfamiliar to us. It was very dusty, and I got a big allergy to dust. And also we had to sleep in horse stalls. So I got a big allergy to horse stander as well. And so I just want to say that for Japanese Americans, when we meet each other, one of the things we ask each other was, what camp were your folks in? This is like a marker. Jerome, Gila, Manzanar, they all, and these camps had different personalities or different characteristics. Tule Lake were the people that were more political, tougher. So I was actually released. Our family, my father refused to be inducted to the army, and we went to, he volunteered to harvest sugar beets in Montana. So we left and we worked on a work farm. So we weren't in a normal concentration camp. And I call it a concentration camp because that's what it was.
My mom was still in Japan. She was in Hiroshima when the bomb was dropped, but she was not in the center. She was out in the country on the other side of the mountain. My dad was in a concentration camp. He was in one place and he moved to another camp because he wanted to be with the rest of his brothers. He was at Tule Lake, and then they were asked to sign allegiance, and they're known as no-no boys, where my father signed no, no, and he was sent to Crystal City in Texas, which was a prison camp. Then later on, he had to get his citizenship back because he signed no, no. But now he hangs the United States flag outside his house. So things have changed in his head.
But Elaine, you're saying that at that time, let's hope it was then and not now, it was possible to lose one's citizenship.
Yes.
And have to, through the legal system, to reclaim it, to
yes.
get it back.
So okay. through attorneys, class action, he got his citizenship back.
I was born in Manzanar. I'm one of, I think, 6,000 or so kids that were born in camp. My parents got married in Manzanar, very romantic story. So I was a year and a half old when we left Manzanar, so I have no real memories of it, but all my life, you know, whenever you fill out a form, you say, well, what city were you born in? Manzanar Relocation Center is what I had to write, and over again. So when we hit the 60s and we were talking about identity, who we are, you know, I'm an American citizen, but I was born behind barbed wire, okay? So who am I? You know, am I American? Am I Japanese? Am I what? you know. What I did was I kind of really got into the culture of Japan, of Japanese Americans. My godfather was a teacher of this instrument. My father played a biwa, a guitar-like instrument. So I grew up in a milieu of artists and musicians, and that's the choice I made, was to study being, you know, who I am. By looking at that, I think by looking at that, we all become stronger too. We know who we are. When somebody says Ching Chong Chinaman, I say, no, I'm Japanese. You know, and it happened to me, you know, and not just, well, go on.
My father was in Manzanar, and he had to serve the American Army. He did a not dishonorable discharge, but he had an honorable discharge because he didn't want to go against his people. So he kind of injured his arm on purpose, so, and his leg, just to get out of there, which was, you know, I thought was great, you know. My dad was really angry at the whole thing, and he would never really talk about it. We have a cafe in Little Tokyo called the Atomic Cafe, and in the beginning, we had this sign that says Atomic, and then there was like a mushroom cloud on top of it. And so, like, people were saying, wow, that's a little harsh, don't you think? You know, it says, well, you know what? I'll take down the cloud, but I'm not going to take down the name, so it's Atomic Cafe. And then from that point on, it's so funny that how this whole thing happened, because later on in my life, I joined a group called Hiroshima, and so it's just like my nickname is Atomic Nancy, because my parents ran the Atomic Cafe. It's fireworks. It's 4th of July bombs. And we do a song called Senbatsuru, which commemorates in honor of the atomic bomb. So highly affected I was behind that, and my parents never really wanted to discuss about camp at all. But I knew there was something stewing, and it was just awful, right? So if anything, you know, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you're all able to, listen to what we have to say. Thank you.
So the camps and how they've affected. Okay, so as I said earlier, I'm a fourth generation Japanese American. So my grandparents, great grandparents, and great great grandparents were in the camps. On my mother's side, they were on Manzanar, which is in the desert of central northern California, about 4 hours north of LA. And on my dad's side, they were in Jerome, which is in the middle of Arkansas. And so my dad is an older gentleman, an elder statesman, if you will. So he was actually in the camps. And so I grew up knowing about the camps. I actually kind of grew up, though, in a very unique situation in that my mom was also a civil rights attorney. So I kind of grew up with this, like, shelf of Asian American literature and just, like, language kind of everywhere, which is not very common in the Japanese American community. So I kind of grew up knowing about the camps in pretty good detail for the most of my life, not fully understanding what they were about, but knowing that. I remember the first chapter book I ever read was called Journey to Topaz by Yoshiko Uchida, which is about a young girl's camp experience. And I remember getting this feeling when I read it in the back of my neck. I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, and not really being able to understand what that feeling was when I read it, but knowing that it affected me really deeply. So flash forward to me being 13, I moved to America. I actually grew up in Canada. So I moved to New Jersey when I was 13 in August 2011. Moved to the suburb of New Jersey, which was 40 minutes out of New York, so it was a commuter town for New York. And a month after we moved there, 9/11 happens. And so immediately, as I'm sure many of you remember, immediately American flags start blooming everywhere. And so I become kind of like fascinated by American flags, because growing up in Canada, you don't really have the patriotism you have down here. It's kind of like, you know, you're proud of beavers and maple syrup, and here it's like flags. So it was like we get here and immediately there are just flags everywhere. And I remember one day counting the flags on the way from our house to this location and coming home to dinner and saying, oh, I counted 128 flags, and my mom just being stone-faced. And sure, my mom, the daughter of folks who had been in camps and who had spent her life like researching and learning about the camps, was just really deeply affected by that. And I didn't understand that either. A week after 9/11, Balbir Sodhi Singh, a Sikh gas station attendant, is killed in Texas. And when I read that, that was the moment that I understood what racism was in practice. I had understood the concept of racism, but seeing how an event like a tragedy like 9/11, while we were still mourning those who were dead, we suddenly had to be praying for those who were alive. And we really had to start worrying about our brothers and sisters who were brown. And so that was the moment that I understood how racism is in practice and understood what happened in the camps. And so I was able to take this camp experience and apply it to the present day. And from that moment forward, I kind of have used that as a framework to better understand racism, both on the social level and on the systemic level. So understanding that is larger than just, you know, black versus white versus yellow versus, you know, whatever. It's not just about let's segment groups out and see who's... There are power dynamics, of course, in place and privilege in place, but there are larger systemic and social structures that we need to break down. So the camp experience has really carried on. And so to the other end of that, on the cultural spectrum, I understand that at that time we were told, you know, my grandmother had an exit interview from the camps when she left. She was about 18 years old. And the FBI agent who interviewed her and did her, you know, check if she's fit to be back in American society, told her, when you're back out there, don't speak Japanese, don't practice any Japanese culture, don't do any of those things. And everybody who left the camps got that lecture, basically. And so we were essentially we were the victims of cultural genocide in that moment. And so for us to reclaim it in this way is a very radical act. It's a political act. I see it as a political act. And so that's why I play the instrument I do. That's why I hang out with these folks. And I speak Japanese even though my parents don't. And so we're in a process right now, two generations later, of reclaiming something that was taken from us.
Wow, right? I hope you see now why I asked the question. If you meet Japanese Americans from the West Coast, whether it's Washington, Oregon, or California, probably the internment is part of their family story. It's important to understand that. And I was much struck by the ways in which several of our panelists were using very strong language to talk about what happened. It's been a long process across many decades and generations to use terms like concentration camp rather than, you know, internment camp or relocation center, right? Or to use words like cultural genocide. I don't know, our understanding, our consciousness is always changing and moving, right? And I think our political understanding of those years is as well. I just briefly want to say that if you ever want to visit Manzanar, which is now a national park, I would absolutely say go. It's in the middle of nowhere, but it's an extraordinary place. And a particularly important day to go, if you can manage it, is the last Saturday every April when the annual pilgrimage to Manzanar takes place, organized by Japanese Americans. It's a day-long event that includes ritual, music, memory, and since 9/11, they have included Muslim Americans very self-consciously and intentionally in the middle of it to think and talk about what it means to have civil liberties violated.
I just want to say one thing in addition to Sean's very right on remarks, is that the experience of being in a concentration camp in America has really helped us understand the experience of Black Americans, of Native Americans. If it weren't for the fact that we were treated this way, I think we would be a less compassionate and political people. For myself, because I have a Black family, and because my son is Muslim, 9/11 particularly had a very scary effect on me. And still, what's going on worldwide with Muslims and Islamophobia has a very big effect on my life. So actually, this helps to expand our consciousness and sensitivity to what's going on around us today.
I realize we only have 6 minutes left, something like that. Very quickly, I'm torn. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the arts, performance, the way in which this becomes so central to these amazing panelists' experience and exploration of Japanese American identity. I also want to make sure that you have a chance to ask questions, because in a way, you can see us do what we do over there, you know, today and tomorrow for sure, if you haven't already. Do any of you have questions? Do you any of you have questions?
Yeah,
yes, sir.
I grew up in the 40s, and we were told there was a great danger of the West Coast Japanese being on the side of Japan and hurting the United States. Were we told the truth, or were we told lies?
The West Coast of the United States has a long history of racism directed toward Orientals, first the Chinese. Right, the railroad workers. Chinese helped the railroads reach Promontory Point, and that whole, there's a whole story that went on about that. Japanese also worked on the railroads and came as laborers, actually as, well, like in Hawaii, as plantation workers. They came to the United States under contracts, the bondage kind of contracts. But to get to the point of, you know, I mean, they said it was for our own good, to protect us, right? That there would be hangings and things like that. Well, how come the machine guns were pointed in, not out? There were machine gun towers at Manzanar, but the machine guns were pointed in. You understand what I'm saying? Just the Hearst newspapers did, you know, the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Grange. It was about greed. It was taking over the land that Japanese Americans had taken land and dug up stones and trees and made this very poor agricultural land into a very productive land. If it weren't for that, California wouldn't have its agribusiness that it has today. You know? And it was a land grab. Part of that story is it was a land grab. Yeah?
There was also yellow journalism. Yeah. So there are images of us in very uncomplimentary caricatures, buck teeth and slanted eyes, and it's calling us the yellow peril. So there was a great preparation leading up to this moment of 1942, and it was a convenience, really, that Japan dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, I mean on in Pearl Harbor, became an excuse to execute, to do Executive Order 9022.
Also more concretely, and this isn't like a conspiracy theory as they say, prior in 1940, I believe, the U.S. government commission was called the Munson Report. And it was essentially a survey to check the loyalty of Japanese Americans. So there were workers from the CIA, I believe, in the Japanese American community observing. And that report came out, and it said that Japanese Americans were actually a little bit too loyal. Like, it was like they were trying so hard to be American, and they were so there that it was like there was absolutely no danger at all. And then once Pearl Harbor happened, that's when Executive Order 906 happened. So.
Hello. I don't know if you guys talked about this earlier, but how do you guys feel about the U.S. dropping two bombs on Japan? Do you feel like there were any other options, or do you think that's like the most we could have done?
That is a very complex question. I think that it'll, obviously we are not speaking on behalf of anybody but ourselves. For me personally, I don't know enough about the politics of the time to fully understand the ramifications. I do think that an atomic bomb is never necessary. I also think that wartime in general is larger than just the bomb. I think it goes back to a history of colonization. I think it goes back to a history of manifest destiny. And I think it goes back to a lot of things that led to a moment where a choice was made. I don't know if I can necessarily say that what the black or white yes or no is on that. But personally, I like to look at the larger picture, and I like to think about, you know, Japan was a country that was closed, and then America came and demanded trade agreements with guns pointed at Tokyo. And then Japan saw that as a threat and chose to militarize. And so at that moment, you had one-upping, because they were seeing how Europe was colonizing the rest of Asia. And so you sort of have this moment where it just becomes, all right, let's see. They're doing something bad, so we're going to do something bad, so they're going to do something bad, so we're going to do something bad, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. And then you have what's happening in the Middle East right now. So this is something that's ongoing, and I think it's a moment where it's hard to look at isolated incidents and say this was right or wrong, because there's so many other layers beyond that.
Japan was ready to give up before, and they knew that they were ready to give up the war. So, and they still dropped the bomb, which I had heard that they wanted to see the result of what the bomb would do. So Hiroshima was a very controlled, it's surrounded by mountains, and they could measure the result of what the bomb could do. So I don't know, have any of you been to Hiroshima? So you saw that space. It's really shocking. And her, of course, her relatives. My relative was killed in Nagasaki. So there were two different kinds of landscapes that they experimented on dropping. They could have dropped it anywhere, but these are the places that they...
I hate to stop, but we do have to. I should say that in half an hour at 1:15, we are going to perform over in the Sounds of California tent. Please join us. What we do is intentional and beautiful and joyous, but here's the thing you need to know is that these stories inform what you are going to see in Fandang Obon. Let me also close by saying that coming to consciousness, as we say in ethnic studies, coming to political consciousness may happen at a particular moment. And for me, I had a great moment when I first heard A Grain of Sand, the album that Nobuko and Charlie Chin and Chris Ijima recorded in 1973. I came to consciousness as an Asian American and listening to that album. However, I would also say that coming to consciousness is a process that goes on and on. So thank you for coming and helping in our continued effort to come to consciousness. Join us over at Fandang Obon in half an hour and be part of that bigger project. Thank you so much for being a great audience. And thank you for sharing your stories.
Thank you so much to Great Leap and for sharing your stories and insights with us. Our next session starts right at 1:00. We'll have the American Immigration Council speaking with some dreamers. While you're waiting for the next session, please take the opportunity to visit one or the other of our red boards to map your own immigration experiences.